This is what I basically, this is my boilerplate that I throw out to a lot of Christians. Do you remember what you said?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Gentiles and then are a footnote in the biblical narrative.
What's that?
That the Gentiles are a footnote in the biblical narrative.
I wanted to hear you say that again, because that made my head kind of explode a little bit.
Yeah.
In a good way. And the second thing is, I wondered if you could just, and you don't have to do this, but because Jim is here, if you could back up and just spend, like, maybe no more than 5 minutes just talking about Shem and that cluster of brothers.
To recap that.
Yes.
If you could just touch on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Just, because that's kind of key.
Those are two very good questions, because ever since this one has been sharing with me the learning experience here, Gentiles are a footnote. That really resonated with me, I got to tell you. It really has.
Yeah.
In a good or bad way?
In a good way.
Okay.
Because I think I said it last week, too, that I kind of always held myself here instead of where I'm, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, and the whole Shem thing, because I think I've listened to either two different episodes of that.
Was that 23 or was, I can't remember
one because I've been cramming them all in. So, but I thank you, because I remember going,
those are pivotal. I don't know if you want to jump in, and I don't want to preempt where you were.
Yeah, let's
starting.
Well, yeah, let's address Eve's question first. I'm just going to restate it for the recording. Eve mentioned Ezekiel 22, verses 17-22. I'll just read it. The word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, the house of Israel has become dross to me. All of them are bronze and tin and iron and lead in the furnace. They are the dross of silver. Therefore, thus says Adonai Elohim, because all of you have become dross, therefore, behold, I am going to gather you into the midst of Jerusalem. As they gather silver and bronze and iron and lead and tin into the furnace to blow fire on it in order to melt it. So I will gather you in my anger and in my wrath, and I will lay you there and melt you. I will gather you and blow on you with fire of my wrath, and you will be melted in the midst of it. As silver is melted in the furnace, so you will be melted in the midst of it. And I mean, the Lord is kicking a dead horse here. It's just over and over and over. And you will know by this, you will know that I, Yahweh, have poured out my wrath on you. So you'll have a couple different perspectives on a passage like this. And this is in regards to last week, my statement about, no, I do not encourage Gentiles to give to the Jews returning to Israel. I don't believe that. What I said was that's a death sentence, right? So I'm taking it from a place like Ezekiel 22. There's many others, but if we again just go back to the blueprint of the Torah, that's where Ezekiel's basing his prophecy, right? So he's not just pulling out a new idea. We have not dug deep into the Song of Moses. But this idea is going to come from a place like the Song of Moses, Deuteronomy 32. But what we have here is Ezekiel seeing likely what's going... he is already in the expulsion from Israel, right? Ezekiel is a part of the tribes that have been taken out of the land. Okay, so here he is. And I'm trying to remember, he's standing on the river Chebar when he starts in the land of the Chaldeans. Okay, so he's exiled from Israel, just like Daniel, just like everyone, these guys were. And he's looking ahead to a prophecy of something that's going to take place again, okay? So, let's talk about the different perspectives. You're going to have a preterist perspective, someone who will say, yes, Ezekiel was looking ahead, but it was fulfilled by 70 AD, okay? Okay, 70 AD was what Ezekiel was foreseeing. Therefore, no prophecy exists any longer. And all things eschatological have been fulfilled. That's preterism in a nutshell. Okay. The futurist, that's preterist, the futurist says, no, yes, there was a type of that, of his prophecy fulfilled in 70 AD, of course, right? But prophecy is prophetic in nature. It has multiple stages often of fulfillment. To just say it terminated at 70 AD is just not very, what's the word I'm looking for? Just not very logical, right? And so, especially in regards to the nature of prophecy in the scriptures. So I hold to that full futurist approach. Preterists hate futurists. Futurists think preterists are stupid, you know, and it goes back and forth all around the theological world. And preterists think futurists are stupid and kind of like not, they haven't advanced in their scholarly theology. But really those break down today mostly into terms like pre-millennial, okay, which is what a futurist would be, myself, right? We are before the millennium, before the millennial reign. Okay, so eschatology is yet to be fulfilled. You have amillennial, which just says, it usually holds a preterist approach that says, well, the millennium is just being fulfilled currently. Jesus is reigning from his spiritual throne, and eschatology is just symbolically being fulfilled currently. Okay, they don't really even have a literal return of Jesus anchored in the future. It's more of like, that's where you'll get more of the pre-trib rapture, you're whisked away to heaven. There's not really a final contention of things on the earth. Then you have a post-millennial, which is a full preterist view. And those guys literally will hold to the fact that Jesus already returned and it was like a thief in the night and the resurrection has already taken place. Okay, so that's, but there are those guys, real big scholars that teach these things. Okay, so that's the theological breakdown.
And the last category that believe that the second coming has already occurred?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the resurrection.
And the resurrection, yeah. And you see Paul rebuke that, actually, in his letters. He says, have nothing to do with these two men who are teaching that the resurrection has already taken place. So it's not a new thing. It was something that was already happening back then.
Not the first resurrection. I mean, you're differentiating. I mean, he resurrected after Christ was crucified.
Yeah.
That took place.
Yeah, it took place. But they're saying that bodily resurrection for people has already taken place. And then you have an odd melting pot of theology today. Modern, untheologically trained generation that just spiritually symbolizes everything and says, well, the resurrection is spiritually taking place now, so we should be able to literally be sinless now. You know, the return of Jesus has no bearing on the future revelation. Like, places like Bethel teach pretty hard against, his name's Chris Ballatin. He's kind of a big opponent of eschatology. Makes fun of the book of Revelation. You know, and just says it's kind of stupid to ever believe that there will be an Antichrist and these sorts of things. Pretty sad. But you have today mainly a group of probably people who just symbolize a lot of the things, and it's called pan-millennial, like, well, it's just all going to pan out. Okay, so those are kind of the main categories. I don't even know if there are others, but so that was just a little our history lesson. But with a passage like this, you're going to have how people perceive Israel. Again, you're going to have a lot of different categories, but just to be real simple right now, you mainly have three categories of people, right? You have people who are supersessionist or replacement theology, people who say none of these passages about Israel matter at all. So they'll normally be preterists because they'll just say, none of that matters. The church became Israel and God has a plan for the future with the Gentile church that is now Israel. So it doesn't matter at all. OK, Okay. Then you have people, the probably two branches of people within the people who still support Israel and think that, no, God still has a plan for Israel. And he's still going to bring forth this people in their calling. And a large portion of people then naturally jump to God is restoring Israel currently, because 1948 happened. The Six-Day War, tons of miracles took place. You have incredible things. And, you know, the truth is there's two sides to the Six-Day War. Remember that book, Jerusalem? Okay, the truth is there are two sides to every story. And there are two sides to the Six-Day War. Did God do miraculous things? Of course. Did he establish Israel? He did. But the question is why? What is the point of him establishing Israel? And I always kind of land on, because it's about his name. Israel and the people of Israel in the land is always attached to his name, right? His name being vindicated. And so he's not just going to let Gentiles just run over his land forever. And in fact, 1948 is a gift, because he was basically taking a stand in the midst of the Council of the Nations and saying, no, I do still care about this piece of land. And yes, I do still have a plan for this people. Okay. But unfortunately, the misinterpretation is God is restoring Israel now. So then people point to, you know, things growing in the desert and different things like that, right? Which I'll tell you, when you go around Israel, it's not sprouting like the Garden of Eden, right? Sure, they have billions of gallons of water fed to a certain place, and that place is growing vegetables, of course, it is. But not too far from that is pure desert terrain, you know? So it's not under the blessing. And so it always just goes back to Torah. Are they under the blessing? Is the land under the blessing? Remember our little, that's why I made that real simple, the gears of scripture diagram. Do you guys have that one? The gears of scripture.
What do you have a number for it?
Around 28.
Was it? I may not have printed that one out. Yeah, it's that one. You got it. Okay.
Which one? What's the
can
number?
Can I borrow it?
Yeah.
It's numbered. Oh, this one's not numbered. Oh, where'd you get yours?
Just write 28 on it.
I just printed it off.
Nice.
Of your...
Yeah. Right. Yes. Just write. Okay. This is 28. That's why we have this real simple... Oh, no, I don't need to. God's covenant. When Israel is in obedience, they're under the blessing, and it just equals some very simple things. They stay in the land. There's peace in the land. They're the head of all the nations. God himself dwells in the land. There's blessing on crops and cattle, lineage, birthing from humans. Birthing from humans. Okay. This is God's faithfulness, right? But God's faithfulness also turns this bottom category, it's his faithfulness to his covenant, either way, because it's his covenantal terms. If Israel's disobedient, there are curses on the land. Israel is exiled from the land. There's war, unrest in the land. They're the tail of the nations. God is not dwelling in the land, and the cattle and the crops suffer. So that's just straight out of Deuteronomy 28. Where the Lord lays out his covenant curses in Leviticus 26. Those are the two big chapters. We're going towards those on our big diagram down here at the end of covenant, which we were approaching today. So, it doesn't take long to walk around the land of Israel and realize that this green gear of blessing is not taking place in the land. Israel is at constant unrest. They're in fear on all sides from their enemies. They are constantly warding off rockets. They have a full defense system to shoot down rockets. There are stabbings in the streets all the time. Their enemies are living in the land. They hate them. They are waiting for the day to kill them, okay? In the land that God chose to be his resting place forever. So we're beginning to see this controversy, right? This squeeze that's taking place in the land of Israel. So that just equals A plus B equals C. God is not restoring Israel currently. And it really is that simple. But then you have people that want to spiritualize a lot of the scriptures and say, well, they'll call me pessimistic. They'll just say, that's an extremely pessimistic view. I just say, no, it's really just the way the Lord laid it out. This isn't being pessimistic. If that's pessimistic, then you're saying the Lord is pessimistic, right? Because I'm just repeating his covenant and the terms. So a passage like that is saying, in his faithfulness to Jacob, to Abraham, remember, there's this time of suffering before the birth. He always likens it to a woman in childbirth. Jesus says that as well in his Gospels. So what is going to give birth to the restoration of Israel that grafts all the Gentiles into the resurrection and into the land promised to Abraham is the pain of childbirth. Okay, so the unfaithfulness of the covenant is coming to a climax at the end of the age. That's why eschatology is not weird. Israel is just finally getting, again, the fullness of their discipline. When the Gentiles kind of move out of the footnotes, Bill, to soften that comment, is, well, number one, the simple principle of the gospel is the first should be last and the last shall be first. God chose Israel, and now Israel is last in the entire world. Everyone looks at them and calls them last. And the Gentiles have made themselves first. But it's this ironic play that the Lord has done. So to where now at the end of the age, when Israel is last, he gives the Gentiles, as we talked about last week, an opportunity to, you know, I don't want to say show our worth. We're still the children of God, but we're not descendants of Abraham. And so there's this opportunity for us at the end of the age to serve the firstborn, to humble ourselves and say, yeah, we weren't chosen. We're just like the Syrophoenician woman. Even the children, Lord, but even the dogs will take the crumbs that fall from the master's table. I love that, because you know what he says? He says, your faith just healed your daughter. Okay, so he looks at a Gentile after saying the Gentiles are dogs, and she responds rightly in such a humble response and says, yes, but even the dogs will eat the crumbs from the master's table. Because it's all about him, right? So even for the Gentiles, it's about him. For the Jews, it's about him and his glory. But in the narrative of history, we are the bad people persecuting his people, Israel, right? The Gentiles are the enemies of Israel. So we're not only a footnote, we're normally a bad footnote. We're the people committing the atrocities against his people. But the glorious, ironic, you know, beauty of God and his gospel is that at the end of the age, the believers in Jesus get to lay down their lives and serve the firstborn, even though we were not chosen. And that, I believe, will be a testimony of Jesus to them. So I tried to answer two questions there. So I'm in the third camp now. There was the camp that Israel's been replaced, it doesn't matter. There's the camp that Israel does matter and God's restoring her now. And then there's a very small minority, right, where I'm at and others like Joel Richardson, Dalton, Thomas. R. Kendall Solon is great. I'm just trying to think of some. Walt Kaiser, awesome. Reggie Kelly is a good one, but it's a small group of people that says, according to the covenant, it's impossible God's restoring Israel now. Why would we ever send them back to the melting pot, right? Why would we send them to their death? So, but you'll come across as pessimistic to a lot of people if you believe that, right? Yeah, extremely pessimistic.
Can I say something? Mm-hmm. When we were in Israel, in 94, we were at the writing wall, and this Jewish woman came up to me, and she said, my mother, the mother, couldn't speak English. She could only speak Hebrew, but the daughter could speak English. And so the daughter wanted to let me know, because I had, you know, the Hebrew books that they have up there. I had no idea what I was looking at, but I was holding it and just looking up, just thanking God and, you know, and praising Him. And so the daughter said, I want you to know that my mother is crying because I guess she saw something in the spirit, because she knew I was a Gentile. Wow. They knew I was a Gentile. And so that was just something. I think it's just, it's the time for the Gentiles to seek, to love, to serve. And God is pulling us in. Those that'll be pulled in to do that.
Yeah.
You know, so, but it made me remember that.
And yeah, see, that's beautiful.
And then I saw the woman, and she was, and she, we didn't really hug, but it was just like an appreciation, tears coming down. So.
Wow. Yeah. That's beautiful. They, I mean, you know, after thousands of years of the Jews being persecuted, it means a lot to them when Gentiles believe in their faith. They don't care about Christians, because, as I've told you many times, Christians come to them with a faith that it doesn't mean anything to them. It sounds just like a normal pagan Gentile religion. It has nothing to do with their people. It doesn't have anything to do with Abraham or that piece of land. It has to do with a crazy idea about going away to heaven as a spirit because of a man who died on a cross and rose from the dead. That sounds crazy, unless you can show them, right, that no, this is the Jewish faith that we're believing in. But because of that divorce, it's hard, Mike, to show them. What are you thinking, Jim?
I am really taken back in a good way, seriously. In Israel, how many per capita believe in Jesus? Like a percentage or something? I mean, is it minuscule?
It's small.
Very, like,
yeah.
Less than 10%?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Less than 10%, for sure. Yeah. I can't remember the amount of Messianics.
What's even smaller is the number of Palestinian Christians. Mm-hmm. I mean, most Palestinians or most Arabs are Muslim, but if, and they're a subset. They're held down and oppressed by the Israelis. And then within that culture, there are Palestinian Christians, and they're like the bottom of the barrel. I mean, they're like triple losers. You know, they're really looking at by their own kind. I mean, it's, and when you talk to them, they're some of the most interesting people.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, the amount of conflict and the different groups.
Well, you know, I'm somewhat ashamed at my age to not have realized this, to, you know, and exactly what you said. The Gentiles have been such an enemy, is a word, right? An enemy. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm. To what God loves the most. Mm.
Wow. That's why it's so important to look at the slice of time from
Christ's
resurrection to around the year 300. Because that period of time, you know, before it really became institutionalized by Constantine and Roman Catholic Church. Because from there on, it's been put in a box, lid's been put on, they duct taped it closed and said, this is what it's all about. But before that, there was a lot of flux going on in the early church and discovery, and it was acceptable to have discussions and try and understand what was Christ's true teaching. I mean, they were really trying to figure out what were Christ's true teachings, I think, in that period of time. And then dogma came along and, you know, it's going downhill.
Well, that's why they spent so much time trying to figure out all the theological circles that have been run around the New Testament, as if the Old Testament did not exist. Again, it's just from that same divorce that happened. So all that's happening these days in theology is people trying to figure out what Paul meant in the New Testament, and they're trying to figure it out apart from the people of Israel. That's why it makes no sense, and it just goes in circles.
And hence, for lack of better terms, the basis behind false teaching.
Exactly. It is the basis behind false teaching. Yeah, when you look at the trajectory of Romans, you get to the end and Paul says, I've written to you very boldly on some points. He's writing to the church in Rome. I mentioned this before, that there was a church in Rome and the emperor expelled the Jews from Rome. We're talking about the city of Rome. And he expelled them from the capital. And there was only then a Gentile church for a period of like 4 years. And then the Jews came back. But what had happened in that four-year period was this arrogance he's addressing in Romans 11 had begun to arise. So the Jews then tried to come back in, and Paul is writing to them in the midst of that and saying, you've become arrogant. And if you have become arrogant, the Lord's going to cut you off, because he cut off some branches so that you could be grafted in, and now essentially you're boasting against the root, which is Christ, who's the head of Israel. You know, it's the Israel and the people of Israel is the key to how the whole restoration works out. It's how God's chosen to restore all things. Mm-hmm. And so without Israel, you have nothing. You have no resurrection. You have no restoration. You have no eternal life. You don't have a king over Israel, and you eliminate Jesus. That's why he says all those things in Romans 9. So the good news is the Gentiles get to become, it's like we get to move out of the footnotes into the main narrative for the end of the age, because Jesus, I believe, is going to raise up Gentiles, like I said last week, who will serve the Jewish people and will radically be a witness and an example of Christ in their time of greatest need. And so it's neat because it gives us a really unique purpose. It does. It makes church history rather sad in a lot of ways when you look back, you know. I try not to get too intense about that stuff, but
I asked an Israeli who was Jewish, devoutly Jewish. I said, so you don't believe in Jesus Christ, that he was born, resurrected, you know, born, died, and resurrected. He goes, well, I believe he was born, and I believe he was a talented rabbi. And I said, but you don't believe he was resurrected? No. And I said, you don't believe he's coming back? No. And I said, well, what are you going to do if he does come back? He said, I'm going to ask, is this the first time you've been here or the second? It's the first question that he's going to ask him. And I'm like, it'll be too late. I mean, because it will be the second coming when he comes back. And it was such a, and I'm not educated enough to even begin to convince him, but I don't think you could. I mean,
Yeah, you can't convince them, and it's not about convincing them, because you have that, you know, place in Isaiah right at the beginning where he just says, let their eyes be dull, their hearts be hard, and their what does he say? It's Isaiah 6. Render their hearts insensitive, he says. Their ears dull and their eyes dim, otherwise they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, and return and be healed. Isaiah 6 verse 10.
See, what do you think the impact of them coming to know Jesus would do to the gears on page 28? I mean, in the top, it would put them back in the top if they...
And that's the whole point of the return of Jesus.
Yeah.
The whole point is he comes back and he puts Israel back into the covenant, and that's why he regathers them from the nations of
the earth. And he opens their eyes, and he opens their ears.
Yeah, yeah. I believe that it can begin happening through the time of tribulation, because I think that's where the Gentiles do become a critical role in being a manifest witness of Christ crucified, right? When Gentiles are literally willing to die and lay down their life to save the life of a Jew, I'm talking about literal martyrdom, I believe that they will be the most powerful witness of Christ. And then take that and say it's an Arab-Palestinian Christian that's willing to lay down their life for a Jew. You have probably the most powerful witness that it will exist in the earth. The martyrdom of a Palestinian who stands up to take a bullet for a Jew, and the Jew escapes, and in that context, the witness of Christ is made known to that Jew, then I believe they will be saved. Their eyes will be opened, you know, in that instant to say, what would make this Palestinian Arab give their life for mine? So that's where we kind of move out of the footnotes, you know. Mm-hmm. Where there's this kind of grand redemption that's sort of, you know, taking place before the grand redemption, in that Gentiles who believe in Jesus are going to, you know, do this reciprocative thing of, this is our identity has always been the enemy of Israel, but now we're going to lay down our life for them. So it's kind of a reciprocation. So, answered your question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Bill, answered one of your questions. What was...
The other one was just if you wanted to go back to...
Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay.
If it's too big a detour, I get it, you know.
It probably is. I mean...
Just don't go there. Just...
Yeah.
Take that as an aside later and talk to Jim. But I do think it'd be good to...
I will all find that and
listen to it, because it's too in depth and it works through a lot of notes. And
but I mean, I heard you you kind of gasp when, what did you say about Abraham, Father Abraham, or I forgot what you said.
Father Abraham had many sons.
Well,
many sons.
I mean, that's exactly what popped in my head. That's what popped in my head. But yeah, so we'll go back.
Earlier, said that we're not the children of Abraham.
Yeah.
And that's probably what triggered that.
And that's what... And sure. Then, yeah,
because
and
we're
then,
not one of the 12 tribes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We're not the physical lineage. We are sons of Abraham by faith, Galatians 3 says.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's... Yeah. But
so it's a spiritual adoption that's taken place through the blood of Jesus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the physical lineage of Abraham was chosen by God, you know, to be the covenant people. And so it's not that one is better than the other. God never says one is better than the other. He actually never says he loves Israel more than the Gentiles. It's not even a greater love. It's a election according to his will and glory. And it has to be attached to that. And so we can't, if we bog down on the God was playing favorite, and you hear people say it all the time, we deal with that in the beginning of the class, you know. If you bog down there, you kind of miss the whole point. It's not that God's playing favorites. It's that God chose to do it this way, and he's God.
It's just as a distinction.
Yeah, it's a distinction. The firstborn son has a delegation from his father of what happens, right, with the household, with the land when he dies, with the will. The firstborn son takes care of those things, right? I mean, that's how it used to be anyway. And the secondborn son wouldn't have to deal with it in the same way. And so it's just a stewardship that's been entrusted to Israel. But we want to honor that stewardship, you know? Honor it, and because it's the way God's chosen to do it. And that's what we're talking about today. So we can just springboard... I'm going to stop this question and answer time and start a new session.